Good morning, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the CEO Story. And we have a fantastic one for you today. We have Marlo Brook, who is the CEO of Avatar Partners. Marlo, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and Avatar Partners?
Absolutely, Casey. Thank you so much for the honor to be on this podcast. I started Avatar Partners 17 years ago, and the term Avatar was very specifically chosen as our name because our mission is to serve those who serve us. So we focus on solutions that will help end users, field service technicians, first responders, healthcare professionals, the warfighter, and anybody who goes into harm's way to make this world a better place.
That's amazing, firstly. So fantastic, and please keep that up. You guys do some absolutely amazing, revolutionary stuff in the AR, VR, and many other like AI fields. Can you just kind of explain at a very basic level what those main fields are and what that really means? And then we can kind of get into more detail.
Absolutely, Casey. Simply put, virtual reality has been heavily used for the past 30 years in both industry as well as gaming. And it's only been in the last 8 to 10, maybe 12 years that augmented reality and mixed reality. So mixed reality is a mixture between virtual, it's really the best of virtual reality and augmented reality. Have been coming into existence as true industrial products that are really enterprise ready. And by augmented reality, what I mean is that the user is able to stay in the, to remain looking and seeing in the physical world with using wearables or tablets or other devices, or sometimes no devices, to see overlays of an object or equipment, such as, let's say, an aircraft or an aircraft maintenance technician. This essentially provides the user with X-ray vision into a system, object, engine, vehicle, whatever it might be, which assists them in very quickly maintaining their task, getting trained very quickly. Also, we use augmented reality for scenario planning, where you have, let's say, first responders who are planning a scenario of a fire in a building and putting that out. We have ways of integrating haptics and sensors and lots of really cool things, artificial intelligence, to make that process easier, better for the user, more powerful, more impactful, and more successful all around.
It sounds amazing, and we've seen bits and pieces of this kind of creep into the commercial world. I think the biggest one of recent years I remember is the Pokemon AI thing that went crazy viral. Obviously, you guys are a lot more sophisticated than that, but just to help people get a context of what that means, can you give us like a specific example of how an industry would use your product?
Sure. So we have examples on air, land, and sea. I'll give you a commercial example in the construction industry. So in the construction industry, they work from a model called a BIM model, which is essentially a design model that helps, or that essentially plans out the design of, let's say, building a new piece of a campus at UC Berkeley or UC Irvine. They're, you know, building sort of like a whole community, the building and then all the surrounding support structures for that. And so they have this very sophisticated design model, and then they then go to actually implement the project. But once you walk out of the trailer away from that PC where that design model sits, the construction industry is still working as it worked 50 years ago. So there's really no exact translation between very sophisticated layouts and the construction in the field. augmented reality bridges that gap by bringing that model into the field in a way that the construction worker can put on goggles with his safety hat, his or her safety hat, and actually see where things need to get laid, where things need to get poured, how things need to get piped, so that it reduces rework and actually, in many cases, eliminates errors. We've gotten to the point where we can eliminate errors in an entire construction building process by using artificial intelligence to do automatic QA on what the user is doing.
Wow, that's so in reality, that's really brought on the construction industry by decades.
Yes.
Wow, that's really powerful.
Yes. And also industries that are hurting right now, oil and gas, obviously, as well as the airline industry. They're seeing a huge, obviously, the COVID economy that is going on right now in the new normal. No one's traveling, and these industries are hit hard. And yet they are going to need to make a rebound at some point. It will need to respond, and when they do, typical of the American economy, everything's going to turn on all at once, like a big light coming on in a stadium. And when that happens, they can have these augmented reality tools to bring in all of the new hires, because they'll have to be rehiring people who will be able to perform maintenance tasks and operational tasks using augmented reality tools to do the equivalent tasks that normally a very senior technician or mechanic or operator would do. So really
great cost benefits then.
Fantastic. It's turning novices into experts.
Wow. All right. It sounds crazy good, but it was only a matter of time when technology could help assist us in this type of way. So if we rewind a few years now and figure out what you did and how other people can also do the same thing to get where you are, you started the company over 17 years ago. What were you doing before Avatar Partners, or how did Avatar Partners come about?
Sure. I get asked that question all the time. So the short answer is 9/11. We all remember where we were and what we were doing and how that devastated our country. And it hit me in the same way that it hit everyone watching this video. And I lost interest in what I was doing. At the time, I was working in software sales for an IBM business partner. I built up a huge territory in the southwestern US over 4 years. We were doing up to $30 million a year in product sales, from 50,000 4 years ago to quite a substantial increase. But it no longer became about the money. I wanted to change my lifestyle and because my motivation was changing. So I shifted from a self-centered point of view to a more of a mission-centric point of view, and creating a business that could make this world a better place every day in whatever way that we could serve. And I really believe that as an entrepreneur, it's very important to do for others. So, one way is, giving a percent, tithing a percentage of your business profits to charities, which we do. I also, however, think that if you can be mission oriented in your desire to make this world a better place in whatever way that is, it's substantially more emotionally rewarding, and it also is financially beneficial, assuming that the market is there for that.
No, I think I think it touches a chord with everyone what happened at 9/11, and the fact that you then went out and started something new and to make that direct difference. And then not only that you started it, but then you successfully executed it over a long period of time, shows a lot of determination and focus and drive. So well done there. That's fantastic. So
well, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, it from the outside, people think that they have perceptions of things that aren't necessarily true. It isn't easy.
So let's talk about that, because that is also one of the things we like to talk about in terms of, this wasn't an overnight success. It took a lot of hard work, time, blood, sweat, and tears. Can we talk about that side of the business and what that really, what it did take for you to make this a success?
Sure. I did start my my business out of my house. My first employee worked at my dining room table, and we grew one person at a time. And today we have four offices, three on the East Coast, DC, Virginia Beach, and Pax River, Maryland. And then we're also out here in Huntington Beach, California, where our US showcase office is. And it was quite a journey. We started working in the commercial industry because that's where my contacts were. Obviously, as an IBM business partner, we were working a lot with things around supply chain, software development. So we were doing both business analysis as well as systems integration for things like electronic data interchange and other technologies. And as we progressed, that mission in my heart never went away. And having that intent, and I'm a big believer of positive visualization and the ability of the mind to manifest. But this doesn't mean that it doesn't take a lot of sweat and thousands of steps to effectively and successfully complete your mission. So it took us a good 2 to 3 years to break into the defense industry, and it was through Northrop Grumman, who is very partial to small businesses, and in particular, women-owned small businesses. And they liked what we did, and we grew there and from one consultant to many. And from there, we started to directly work with the Air Force and the US Navy. And now we work with all branches of the military, as well as the commercial segments that we have had past relationships in.
That sounds fantastic. If we could break that down into, how did you get your first contract when you were at your dining room table, and then scale it from there?
Sure. I got my first contract from Disney. It was a relationship that I had prior to starting Avatar Partners, and it was a business assessment, and it was dealing with UCCNet and basically standardization of data between trading partners so as to facilitate communications and speed the flow of money. And that contract I won, it was signed, and I went to go, you know, put on my consultant hat and go do the work, and went to their offices, and they said, we really don't need this. We don't really need your help with this. So I got a contract. I just didn't execute the contract. So that was the first lesson learned.
It's really, did they pay you or not?
What was that?
Did they pay you?
They didn't pay us, because I never did the work. We never did the work.
Oh, wow.
Then I learned the power of, you know, visualization. Sure, visualize yourself closing the contract, but remember that you actually have to complete the work and get paid.
Two more steps after the contract.
But with that lesson learned, we, you know, we progressed, and we really found that, you know, really it's all about adding value. So to me, I see, you know, because of the long hours that entrepreneurs work, that we're often mistaken for people who live to work. And I don't see it that way. I don't live to work. I work to live. But the thing that I live to do mostly is to create. And to me, business is a creative process. Business is my canvas. And so, you know, business in that way, it's a very complex creative process in that it involves people. It involves relationships. Everything's about relationships. And sometimes when we're talking about hundreds and thousands of people for a given project. And, you know, there's also that creative aspect of understanding what a person or an organization's needs are and the creative process of developing a solution that fits perfectly with what they need. So what I found with moving into the military sales that I found so delightful is that they involve all levels of users, from the actual users to, you know, the soldier that's, you know, doing, you know, he's the feet on the street, the boots on, you know, the boots on the ground, all the way up to the leadership echelons. And decisions are made at every single level. And when we were started to work in that capacity, we realized that the amount of understanding it took us to truly understand their needs at such a minute level, you know, was a creative process unto itself. And I found it very fun.
Yeah, I think the government is a huge beast to work with. If you could break down the steps that it took to transition from kind of commercial into government contracts so that people could really understand the amount of work and effort that goes into one, even just getting registered and being able to bid on these things, to then winning and being the preferred user for your specific niche. I think that would be really interesting to dig into that.
Yes, there is a big difference between commercial sales and military sales. Commercial sales are much more focused on return on investment. There's an ROI there. Or there's, you know, either a way to save money or, more importantly, make money, then it's black and white. It's a black and white decision to some degree. In military, everything is about relationships. So the military has a lot of needs. They have more needs than they have solutions, I can tell you that. And they are very exacting. They're perfectionists. Because if any mistake is made anywhere, we're talking about safety of life. So they take that to a degree that goes into writing, drawing up proposals and contracts. If you have a misspelling, or you're not using the right font to respond to a proposal, that means you can't follow orders. And that means that could eventually result in the warfighter having a safety of life issues. This is how they see things. Everything is serious. Everything is life or death in military. So it's understanding how important it is that what they're doing. And then it's also about building relationships and not expecting something from day one. It takes years to develop relationships. And it just like it takes years to develop trust. We all know that. You know, it takes a lot to build up trust, and it takes very little to destroy trust. So what we did was we just went in like on a crawl, walk, run type of a basis. You know, we started, I was actually the first consultant that went in to Northrop Grumman and actually was doing work with the software engineers. And then another person came in, and suddenly we had a team, and things grew from there. We were working with mission planning systems. And if you develop the reputation of always delivering high quality product on time and within budget, that's what they care about. And it's really one step at a time. It does take time. And the other thing is, the other big difference that I've seen between military and commercial is that usually in commercial, companies shy away from having partners. because they kind of want to do all the work themselves and they see maybe a loss of control. Military is exactly the opposite. In military, you're dealing with multiple teaming partners. They call them teaming partners. And as with teaming partners, we're sort of working in a badgeless environment where it doesn't matter that I'm Avatar Partners and that this other gentleman is Lockheed Martin or Boeing, and the third gentleman is actually a government representative. We're all one, and we all have one collective vision. So it really requires that humility of just taking off the, it's all about our company, to more of working in a capacity of service.
So there's no egos, and it's all about finding the solution that works for the military, ultimately.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds very military-esque framework, but it makes sense, really, because the margin of error is just so low. You can't really can't mess things up when they're that serious, especially with the types of things that you guys do on certain aircraft and things like that, where it is live or die. If that thing doesn't work properly, then you could have a multi-million-dollar incident and also a loss of life. So you can understand why it is so strict and regimented. How long did it take you to win your first government contract?
Well, like I said, it was about 2 years after our company got started.
2 years.
So what we did was, the best way that I can recommend going in is not directly to the government customer. That's a hard path to go through as a beginner, because you don't have any past performance. That's what they care about. They want to know that you've done exactly what you've done before. It's a little bit of a catch-22. The best way for a small company to support the government is to first work through the prime contractors who know what they're doing. Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, you know, the big GDIT, GTR, Georgia Tech Research Institute, the large prime contractors, SAIC, because they know what the military needs. And I can guarantee any company that hasn't done any work for the government, and particularly in defense, you're clueless. You don't even know what they need. We didn't know what they needed. And we actually were very honored to be able to be mentored by the large primes, who taught us a lot about exactly how things should be done. So it was a good learning experience. So I would recommend taking that route first. Every large prime contractor has a small business liaison, and that's a good way to start. But I would also work on making relationships with the program managers of these large organizations. You know, find a program manager who has a project and a problem, and see if you can fill that need and develop a relationship. And don't expect that you're going to get it from day one. Expect that this could take a couple of years.
And I think that's really good expectation setting, in terms of people just think overnight you got this contract and away you went, when it was years of building those relationships and finding the right place where your solution can actually be viable and is needed. Because although your solution's fantastic, it doesn't mean that it is needed at that point in time on that contract. So to continue to keep looking and finding a good fit, and then that's a different type of relationship at that point, where you have one foot in the door with the government, and then once you get that past performance, your actual real performance can speak for itself to become the prime. Does that sound about right?
Absolutely. Once you build that reputation of being on time, within budget, and satisfying the customer, and even delighting the customer, the military will come to you. They won't let you go if you do good work. And this is the reason why most of our work, we've really never, in the past, we haven't advertised. We just get more work because we do great work. We have moved into more of that with augmented and mixed reality, obviously because of so much demand from different industries. However, you know, that's That's really what is needed.
So it comes back to really mastering your trade and really delivering a very good product that speaks for itself, so that you don't have to push as hard on the marketing and the sales, because you know that you produce quality goods.
Right. And the other thing is, you cannot push the government to make a decision. The military, the government, every government entity, it's usually hundreds and thousands of people who contribute to the vision and know things that we'll never know. They have needs that we don't even know about, nor should we. And that, don't ever push. And also know yourself. So don't be all things to all people. Know what you are good at and know what you're not good at, and find a swim lane that resonates with a need. And everything that the government needs is, it's everything's fair game. It's publicly displayed, it's published. Anyone can have access to what types of projects are needed, and they're more than happy to explain the proposal process. There are SBA offices, which is the Small Business Administrative Offices, all over the country. That is a great place to start with, because they can point you in the direction of, you know, how to get started, how to get registered on SAM, how to get registered on all these different sites, and move through and get on these different, what they call contract vehicles, which is simply a way for the government to get to you and pay you money for your services.
Fantastic. So some great nuggets of information there on how to build up your business, both in the commercial and in the government sector. I'd like to end with one question, Marlo. And it's, if you had to apportion your success between three factors, one being drive, two being skill, and three being luck, what percentage would you allocate across those three factors?
So drive, skill, and luck?
Lucky. How lucky were you?
Oh, luck.
Sorry, it's the English accent.
or sorry, my bad American accent. So luck, I would cross out.
Okay.
Drive and skill, I would put as the highest. And I would say drive is the most important.
Fantastic. So can you just elaborate a little bit on that? Because it's not often that people scratch out luck. So I'd love to hear your thoughts around that.
People usually say luck, but they're being modest. I really do believe that drive is everything. The reason is because this is not an easy road to be an entrepreneur and to have your vision. And trust me, I am a number one believer that if you can conceive it, you can create it. It just depends on how hard are you willing to work on this? How far are you willing to go? So the drive is what will take you through the hard times. When you fail, like at that first contract I got and never actually got, it'll take you through the bad economic times, such as global pandemics, or the crash of 2008. Some people call that a recession, some call it a depression. We certainly went through that. We went through a huge issue last year. And it's gotta be the drive, because you will have you'll have more failures than you have success. And the good thing about that is you do not learn from your successes, you learn from your failures. So just know that you will fail a lot, and welcome that failure as a learning experience. And as we do that, we become even stronger, because, you know, as they say, if it doesn't kill us, it makes us stronger. I think that's a saying from the Marines. And I think that's very true.
Fantastic. Wow. Some great insight there. So I'd like to thank you, Marlo, for your time and sharing all those golden nuggets of information. We'll put the links below to Avatar Partner so people can learn more about that. And that's it. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Casey. You have a wonderful day.